This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good afternoon, Rutherford County, and welcome to the changing weather, as it seems like it's about every other day. We've run into a mess, and Greg, I was looking. Of course, everybody knows that Greg Tucker's on Tuesdays, and they said we've only had 1.7 inches of rain in the last 2 days. I'm trying to figure out where in the world they're measuring.
He's got a hole in his bucket, I think.
He's got to have a hole in his bucket.
I'm out Donald's Chapel out towards Bradyville, and we measured 5.5 inches last night before I went to bed, and it hadn't quit raining yet.
I was going to say, through yesterday, most places had 4 to 5 inches in the county, according to the National Weather Service website. So,
and that's Mr. Brian Barrett, as everybody knows that voice. And I was listening to you last night, Brian. I was trying to pick up the Braves, and I got you. And, you know, you had a great show on last night. Well, and I thought you were going to take the day off.
Well, we were followed by Rick Stockstill Live, of course. He was talking about...
Great game.
Yeah, disappointed that was a loss there, but... I'm looking forward to seeing the Raiders this year, but got to the game after that, which at that point the Phillies had already kind of rocked.
It was blown out then. I was glad I wasn't listening to it. But I think he's got a great team. They were more than competitive with Purdue Saturday. In fact, mm-hmm. I think they really should have won. It was just one of those things that a couple of things happened that didn't go their way, and that's football.
That's the game. Yep. But yeah, 6.35 inches down toward Bedford County, by the way. So 5 to 6 inches is very common. Few places like Laverne, Smyrna, 4 inches.
So right. Did you see anything that was 2 inches? Because I'm trying to figure out where the national weather is measuring all this stuff.
Now, that could have been maybe a one-day total.
Yeah.
What's the prediction now for when it clears off?
Pretty cool this week, I think. Mid-70s.
Going to stay cool, yeah. But when are we going to see some sunshine?
I think tomorrow's about a 40% chance of rain, and then Thursday drops off to about 20%. So I think the rain...
Truman, he's being evasive.
The sun's coming back toward the end of the week.
The sun's coming back.
He's been here long enough to really know how to be a weatherman. Have you ever noticed it? It's the same.
They give you those percentages. And, you know.
Yeah, he leaves an out for himself.
Yeah, those rain totals are from Saturday. So
from Saturday.
Saturday to today, yeah.
Okay.
So 6 inches in, 4 days?
Yeah. And a lot of the, just like the bridge over there on Elam Road, of course, the slab, you can't get back in there to it. It's completely underwater. But the water has actually been over the little small bridge on Elam that sometimes the water will get up almost to it, but it's been over it this time. In fact, it was hitting the bridge when we went by on our way over to 231 South today. Want to let you know that the first half of the show is brought to you by Stan McNabb Automotive, where they provide quality vehicles from Chevrolet, Dodge, Jeep, Ford, and Cadillac to the Murfreesboro, McMinnville, and Shelbyville, Tennessee area. And they have a large selection that ensures that you can have a vehicle for everyone, no matter what it is you're looking for. And for a quality used car in Tullahoma, visit their dealership located at 2000 North Jackson Street. And they also have a large inventory of pre-owned cars, trucks, SUVs, and minivans to select from. And at Stan McNabb's, they provide themselves in the quality that they offer on all of their used cars, which makes them a major destination for used vehicles. And they throw in an extra caveat. You can also get oil changes and tires for the life of that vehicle. So I don't think you can find a better deal anywhere and find nicer folks anywhere. Greg, I had a call from a friend of mine, Regina Nelson, a couple of weeks ago, and she said that she just happened upon a cemetery that is off of the Manchester Highway, in between Manchester Highway and the interstate, at the Beech Grove exit.
Oh, yeah.
And I had never heard of that one, so she knew that I was interested in history, so I went over. And my wife and I did, and we took a look. Very small, but it was very appropriate, I think. And I thought, you know, we need more of that to honor. I mean, we're honoring everybody that fought in that war primarily, and you should not leave any of the people off, because they were all fighting for a cause that they believed in. They were all Americans at the time, and there were a lot of situations that caused that war, and a lot of them were not brought to mind as accurately as they should be, as you and I know. But it was very poignant, because they had little buttons up there that would describe what happened and how they actually made that cemetery, who was buried there. And
a lot of those graves are unknowns.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. In fact, most of them were unknown.
Yeah, I think the Confederate graves are all unknowns. Next summer, the Sons of the Confederate Veterans are going to have their national reunion, mm-hmm. or convention, here in Murfreesboro. And I'm hoping that over the course of that, there'll be some focus on that particular little cemetery, because I believe I'm right that is the first Confederate cemetery as such set up during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're familiar with Colonel Wilder, the Yankee colonel that came through here, and he couldn't get the arms he wanted for his group. Because he had learned about a new concept or a new invention called a repeating rifle. Mm-hmm. And he made contact with some people back in his hometown in Kentucky and literally borrowed the money personally from bankers up there. Of course, his family was a wealthy family anyway. He bought the guns and armed all of the men in his brigade, Wilder's brigade, and they were the lead group when the Yankees made their thrust down towards Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. And he went through, of course, you know, they fainted over towards Shelbyville, and a good bit of the Confederate forces had moved over about where Fairfield is now. But then he went tearing down through Hoover's Gap with those repeating rifles. And the few Confederates that were there for the purpose of holding the gap all had the muskets still.
Mm-hmm. And Didn't have a chance.
Apparently it was just a massacre. There wasn't anybody left standing on the Confederate side. And Wilder was moving so fast that they just tore on through there and left bodies everywhere. Well after they had gone on down towards Chattanooga, the local people gathered up all the bodies. Now, most of the time when the Confederates fell, you know, it was, of course, on private property, almost mm-hmm. all these battles. The local people, the farmers, the property owners, would bury them where they fell. Mm-hmm. So they were scattered all over in unmarked graves. In fact, we were finding graves on up in 50 years later still. But in this case, they gathered them all together and took them up on the hill and made a cemetery for the unknown Confederate dead who had died in that battle. The markers you see there came many years later. Mm-hmm. Originally, they had just wooden crosses and such marking where the graves were. But that Beech Grove Cemetery is significant for those several reasons. The battle, it was the first battle ever using repeating rifles. Mm-hmm. It clearly was, I think, significant. It was a skirmish, not a full-scale battle. It was a skirmish, but it's significant because it was the beginning of the thrust mm-hmm. that eventually cut the Confederacy in two down through Atlanta and onto the sea. And then it was the first time that there had been a cemetery as such set up with the Confederate dead. So it is significant. I'm glad somebody's discovering it. Mm-hmm. Very easily accessed because you got the exit off the interstate there. There ought to be a marker historical site on the interstate. And
there's not.
No.
Coming off the interstate, it's harder to see than if you come off Manchester Highway.
Well, if you come off the interstate going north and swing over on the Manchester Highway, you go right around it.
Right.
Because it's right there in that little corner there. Up high on a hill, mm-hmm. and an appropriate place for a memorial like that. I have camped there with a group of scouts.
Mm.
We camped over on the side of the cemetery, and the reason I chose it was I wanted to make a lesson out of it, and we played a scavenger hunt where they had to research the tombstones and such to learn about it. I believe one of the camps of the Sons of the Confederate Veterans have responsibility for the area, you know, and have maintained it.
And it's over in Tullahoma, I think. I think they've got the people that maintain it are over in that area.
Yeah, it's not the Murfreesboro camp.
No.
I believe it's down that way. And, of course, it is just over the county line into Coffee County, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, Coffee County.
Uh-huh. And it really struck me as the... They put a lot of effort in that. I mean, we're talking about just a few people. Usually you have grants or organizations, large organizations that get involved with a lot of money, just like we've got the one here in Murfreesboro, Stones River, and it's extremely well-kept and very large. And the one out there is very small, but it has just as much significance to me as the Stones River one because of all the effort that these few people actually put in. And I always wondered, here we are in the South, and the people who represented this particular area, a lot of them are just unknown. They're just forgotten, or there's been very little effort put in to memorialize those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that, but if you want to go out there, I would take the Manchester Highway, and then when you get to the Beech Grove exit, just turn into there, and you'll see it up on your right. It's on the hill.
Yeah.
And you will we were by ourselves for a long time up there, and just kind of enjoying being there and listening to all of the history of the place. And then I found it interesting. Only one other person came, and he had his kids in the car. And he got his camera out, and I don't think he was from here. He was from another state. I didn't see which one.
Well, you know, the state of Tennessee has put out for this sesquicentennial, 150th anniversary, literature on, you know, Civil War trails to be followed from play. I wonder if that's on any of those.
Well, it should be.
Certainly should be. And it really should be better marked so people can anticipate, because as much... You know, I'm sure you've read that the most visited, call it a tourist attraction, most visited historic spot or whatever in Rutherford County is the battlefield.
Right.
We have people coming from all over this part of the country to see the Stones River battlefield. I would think, as you say, that this would be just as interesting.
I think it is.
If you know, they had the information that would get them to it.
If they could just recreate things in a way that is accurate to what actually happens. And you know, sometimes that's very difficult, especially when you're talking about all the damage and what happens during a war.
Well, all of our lives, and perhaps for another generation, this sounds like a cliche, but we're still fighting that war.
Yeah.
And, I mean, 100 years ago, it was obviously much more personal when there were still the veterans alive, but... Today, almost every week, I read something in a paper where somebody or some group is putting their spin on it.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we all have different political views of it. And yes, we were on two sides at least.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping that someday we'll all appreciate that there was tremendous sacrifice made on both sides. There were certainly both sides, I think, were wrong in the sense that they went to war, terrible losses. I mean, Rutherford County is a good example of a part of the South that just was completely destroyed during that time. I know you've had other guests on that have talked about it in specifics, but it's hard to imagine that, you know, an agricultural economy just completely flat on its back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the exploitation that was going on with those coming down from the north, and some of our own people taking advantage of the situation, was very sad. But at the same time, there were heroic efforts, some of which we celebrate, Sam Davis,
right,
and such, and some, like what you just brought up. Can you imagine trying to make a stand with a small group against a brigade coming through with weapons you had never seen or imagined? You know, you're firing and getting off one or two shots a minute if you're really good with a musket, and they're unloading clips of 12 shells just in a matter of minutes.
It's almost like out in the West, where the the U.S. military was fighting the Indian nations, and they had their rifles, and the Indians had their bow and arrows. And, and you can see, I mean, it's totally one-sided when you get into a situation like that.
Right. And unless there's
but that's why I appreciate you and some of the others around here who are members of the Rough County Historical Society, is you guys work hard to make sure that the real history of what happened here is preserved. Because if you're just getting a one-sided point that's pretty much set standard for this area, you're not really getting the true history of what happened. And there were a lot of people that sacrificed on both sides, as as we know. There are a lot of heroic deeds that happened around here. And it wasn't just the soldiers when we're talking about down here in the South. It was families. It was the women. It was the children. All of those people sacrificed unbelievably during that time.
Yeah, the home sacrifice, or the home front, as we call it, was tremendous.
Now, we were... last time you were on, we were in a discussion about the true center of the state of Tennessee, and we had not a really disagreement, but you were educating me to the real facts of what happened,
and you were just a shade disappointed.
yes.
Well, that's true about a lot of history, not just local history, but a lot of history. Details disappear as we focus on, you know, the large event or the primary significance. But the story of the geographic center of the state of Tennessee is a fascinating story, and it takes off in several different directions. And, of course, that was the second time that Murfreesboro made a big pitch to become the state capital. Mm-hmm. In the early years, there was no state capital as we think of it now. Certainly no building, but there really wasn't even a town that could claim to be the state capital. What we had was a general assembly, a legislature, mm-hmm. state legislature, who met where it was convenient to meet. And in the earliest days, that was up in East Tennessee, because that's where most of the population was centered. Mm-hmm. Knoxville had...
everything moved west.
Yeah, but as it moved west, mm-hmm. it was in Knoxville and one other small town up in that area, and then it moved down to Nashville. And met in Nashville for several years. The significance there is during that period, they set up the state penitentiary, we call it now, and they set up the state bank. Then they decided, well, let's meet in Murfreesboro. And I just, you know, when they adjourned the session, I believe it was about 1816, you know, our next gathering, next assembly, will be in the new little town. Murfreesboro in Rutherford County. So we claim, and it's fun to claim, that for a period there we were the capital of the state of Tennessee. Well, Murfreesboro was the place where the General Assembly was meeting for a period from about, I may have the year off, about 1817 through about 1825, 26. And then they decided to move back to Nashville. But while they were meeting down here, obviously the local folks got excited about the possibility that Murfreesboro could become the state capital. And one fellow in particular, Isaac Hilliard, H-I-L-L-I-A-R-D, he was the son-in-law of Colonel Hardy Murfree, had married a daughter who had inherited virtually everything adjoining the original city to the south. And he was, in 1818, getting ready to subdivide a portion of it, which we would now know would be from about the back half of the south side of the square down to Academy Street, the middle of the block behind Academy Street. He was getting ready to subdivide that and make him a little money, obviously. And at the time, he lived in North Carolina. He never moved over here, but he knew the family property. Probably was over here, but his business address, which you find in the deeds, was still North Carolina.
Was he doing a lot of his business by mail?
I doubt it. I imagine that he was working through other family contacts and probably had attorney, representatives, surveyors over here. Wish we could track you know, how often he came here. He mm-hmm. apparently, because you can see in the correspondence, he knew what he had. And it's interesting, he had some that Colonel Idle thought he had. Mm-hmm. And that's another story, but there was a conflict there. But he took what is now the block, the city block. It's very different now. Between Academy and the next street over, and which would be Walnut, I guess, today. Mm-hmm. A whole block there, which now the Coach's Grill is in that block. Castle would have been the bottom side of it.
Yeah.
And he offered to give that to the state of Tennessee as a site for the Capitol. And, of course, the city fathers and the locals got behind that and started pressing. This is 1818. Not to be outdone, because apparently the Lytles and the Hilliards and the Murphys were very competitive. Colonel Lytle, who just a few months before had started selling off the north side of the city, subdivided it, was selling it off, he dedicated about an equivalent block size just north of his subdivision for the same purpose. So then the city, not wanting to choose between their own very powerful families, they offered both of them. And
split up the power.
Yeah. And that might have been part of the problem, instead of really getting behind one. They offered both of them. Well, it came out a stalemate, because at the same time, representatives in the legislature from various parts of the state, including Nashville, of course, were also protecting, you know, their interest, and they wanted the capital. And as I've said many times, all this is what I call profit motive, which I'm very high on. That's what made us a great country, is our freedom to try to better ourselves and better our values and such. So the legislature essentially said, threw their hands up, you know, we're not going to make any decision. So it cooled off. And then in about 1830, the issue came up strong again, because by then the Capitol had been in Nashville about 4 years, or the General Assembly was meeting there, and Murfreesboro, Knoxville, and even Williamson County started pressing hard, you know, we need to sit a permanent place. And state senator from Williamson County, on the record, and I've read this legislative record, he brought up what appears to be the first document we can find, the point that the Capitol should be as close to the real center of the state as possible for the convenience of the citizens, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know what he was thinking.
Yeah.
Williamson County was quite likely, from the point of view then, Williamson County was quite likely going to be about the center of the state. Well,
you look at the map and you can't tell.
And, of course, Nashville said, well, we're awfully near the center of the state. Rutherford County took the position, well, you know, if that's the criteria. So you had several of the powerful groups saying, well, yeah, it ought to be near the center of the state. On Friday of one weekend during the, it was in 1832, the issue was being hotly debated. And the General Assembly, again, I think kind of passing the buck, turned to the Secretary of State, which in those days sat with them and kept the records and the minutes, and said, determine where is the real geographic center of the state of Tennessee. This was on a Friday. Well, the poor fellow who was the Secretary of the State at the time knew he was on the spot, apparently. He immediately went to the University of Nashville and apparently hired, contracted with a professor.
Now, what is the University of Nashville?
That's the predecessor of Vanderbilt University.
Okay. Now, was it a private school at that time?
It was a private school at the time.
Okay.
And, well, it was private Catholic, not Catholic, Methodist. And it was located, if you know Nashville at all, the Howard School, which is now county offices in Nashville, is on the campus. And the medical school building is still standing there on the campus. The Children's Museum in Nashville, when you and I were kids, is on the old University of Nashville.
Yes.
In fact, that's one of the original buildings. That building's still there. So he hires this professor of geography or whatever his credentials were on a Friday afternoon. On Monday morning, the professor announced his determination.
I wonder how he did it that quick.
He took the map, which is called the Ray Map, R-H-E-A. It was done by a surveyor named Ray in the 1820s. Now, you can guess how sophisticated cartography was back in the 1820s. Mm-hmm. All he had to work from, or all he chose to work from, was that map and mathematical calculations. Now, I have read over several times the description of what he did, because on Monday morning, he had a letter that he had given the Secretary of State that the Secretary of State gave back to the General Assembly, meeting his obligations. And he somehow divided the map into four sections, quadrants, and mathematically plotted the center of each one of those four sections of the state of Tennessee according to this 1820s map. Mm-hmm. And then took the diagonal center of those four points as the geographic center of the state.
Of course, there was an outcry.
No, I think when he put it in, there's absolutely nothing in the record other than the fact that here's what he presented. Mm-hmm. I think they looked at it, and their reaction probably is very similar to mine. How in the world did he do that? Because there was never a vote. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people will tell you this is determined by the legislature to be. Mm-hmm. Well, there was no vote. He turned in his letter. The Secretary of State presented it, apparently, to the General
Assembly. He wasn't an expert witness, right?
No, they didn't call him forward. And the letter is in the legislative record, but there was no vote to accept as, you know, it was just put on the record. They decided that year that they would put off the decision 10 years. Hmm. And they voted eventually that in the 1842 session of the legislature, a decision would be made for a permanent state capital. So you talk about passing the buck. They kicked it forward 10 years and tried to make it a law that they had to determine at that time. They did in that time.
Can you imagine them getting away with that now?
Didn't you follow the debt crisis? very similar resolution.
You're right.
Now, I'd like to think that the Tennessee legislature would be a little more creative. Back to the question of the geographic center itself. This college professor said it is approximately something on the order of 2 miles due east of the Rutherford County Courthouse, the square. All right. And to jump ahead, if you'll go to the monument today out in Las Casas Pike, that's not due east. That is very much northeast.
Right.
Okay, he said due east. But in the original reference from the Williamson County representative, he made the point that it should be in the vicinity of or proximate to the geographic center of the state.
Mm-hmm. He left himself a little room.
Yeah, left himself a little wiggle room. Mm-hmm. So what then happened was that the Rutherford County, the Murfreesboro leadership, city fathers, looked for an available, appropriate site close to the geographic center. Because right now, that geographic center, roughly calculated as he did, still in more or less wasteland, kind of a remote area. Mm-hmm. And they found this big, flat rock, not hard to find in Rutherford County, just a little off the pike. And they said that's where the state capitol should be. And Abe went out there and marked the corners of the state capitol and made that their rallying cry. Murfreesboro, the geographic center of the state of Tennessee, should be the capital because we're in the center.
Now, who owned that piece of property?
It was privately owned, but apparently made available. I can tell you who owned it later, but at the time, I'm not sure who. But it was privately owned, but not the type of property that you could grow anything on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they were ready to make it
available.
That's
unusual to find in Rutherford County.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and let you know that this part of the show is brought to you by At Home Care. And they are located at 237 Castlewood Drive, Suite H, right behind Kroger's on Memorial Boulevard. And you can reach them at 713-4639 or check out their website at www.athomecaretennessee.com. And what they do is they offer the service of going into your home and taking care of the normal tasks that you normally would be able to do. But as you've gotten older or maybe having some health issues, you can't do it, and you're trying to find a way to maintain your quality of life at home. And that's the place to call. And let me give you the number again. It's 713-4639, or you can reach them at www.athomecaretennessee.com.
Hi, this is Chuck Lewis with First Bank in Murfreesboro.
And Jim Bryan of First Bank in Smyrna.
Did you know that Social Security and other federal benefits are moving to a paperless system?
If you're currently receiving a paper check from the government and want to know more about how you can make the transition to direct deposit, stop by your local First Bank branch or call 890-1111 in Murfreesboro or 267-1111 in Smyrna.
That's 890-1111 or 267-1111. First Bank, member FDIC.
Hello, good neighbor listeners. This is David Hoover with Rutherford County Farm Bureau. We'd like to show our appreciation to all of our Farm Bureau members by inviting you to our annual meeting Monday, September the 12th at the Lane Agri Park Center, 315 John Rice Boulevard. We'll be serving the barbecue from 5 to 6:15 with the meeting at 6:30. We appreciate our Farm Bureau members and look forward to seeing you there. If you need more information, give us a call at 893-1213 or visit our website at rcfarmbureau.org.
Self-storage has never been so convenient. Thanks to Zippy Shell, providing self-storage and moving solutions right to your front door. We deliver, you pack it, we pick it up and store it. Our units are secure, convenient, and best of all, they're just as affordable as traditional ones. Zippy Shell. Call us today for a free estimate.
Call locally owned Zippy Shell today. 216-7879. That's 216-7879.
Hello, this is Jim Bryan at First Bank.
And I'm Chuck Lewis. First Bank presents Good Neighbor Events, news of what our local schools, churches, and community groups are doing.
Good Neighbor Events brought to you by First Bank. And on Tuesday and Thursday evening, free GED adult classes at two locations here in town, and they both offer child care. One is at the Patterson Community Center, and the other is over at the Franklin Heights Family Learning Center. For more information, call 893-5812. And if you need some exercise and would like to meet some nice folks and perhaps take some international trips, check out the Cripple Creek Cloggers. They practice tonight at 7 at First Baptist Church over on East Main and Spring Streets in uptown Murfreesboro. Now tomorrow and Thursday from 9 until 2, the USDA Commodity Distribution. That's over at the McFadden Community Center at 211 Bridge Avenue. And remember, commodities are available to households meeting income eligibility guidelines. So be sure to bring your proof of the household income for 1 month and the Social Security number for each family member. Once again, the commodity distribution is Wednesday and Thursday from 9 until 2 at the McFadden Community Center. Oh yes, the Chamber University from 7:45 to 10 this coming Thursday morning. And Reeve Sain's Jim Janae will talk on developing the best business practices with an understanding of how you think and how your thinking can be strategically enhanced. That's $20 for Chamber members and $30 for non-members. For more information, call the Chamber of Commerce at 893-6565. Remember to get those Good Neighbor Events to us at least 2 weeks before they occur. Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by First Bank.
This is Sean Brown at Southeastern Tire Service, where we now offer the Michelin Promise Plan. The Michelin Promise Plan is a new offer which includes a 30-day ride guarantee, 3-year flat tire changing assistance, and a limited mileage warranty on all Michelin passenger and light truck tires, replacement and original equipment. Did you know we now provide air conditioning service? Let our ASC certified technicians get your car road ready today.
Southeastern Tire Service on Broad Street across from Advance Auto.
You're listening to The Truman Show on WGNS, AM and FM. Now back to Truman Jones.
With today's guest, Greg Tucker.
Sausage and biscuits, gravy and grits, home ground, homemade, it'll get you fits. Blueberry pancakes and corn cakes too, I'm a-licking my lips, now how about you?
Readable Mill is starting to be a place that everybody wants to go on Saturday morning from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. And everybody knows by now that Tom Brady refurbished the old mill, and it will be 200 years old next year. And everybody wants to go there now. And you need to get there as early as you can or call 563-6455. Or on the internet, readablemill.com, about 10-15 minute ride down John Bragg Highway from Murfreesboro, and it's on your left. You'll see the sign, and you will go back in time and have probably one of the most wonderful times that you can ever have. And when you go back in history and you see all the wonderful things that they've got, and it's one of the few actually operating mills still left in this country. So be part of it. Be part of the history and take off and just have yourself a great time. All right, we're still on the center of the state.
Our marker over there actually marks the spot that was chosen by the Murfreesboro-Rutherford County leaders back in the 1830s as the place that they would propose and promote for the capital. That's really what's being marked there. Mm-hmm. And just out of curiosity, I asked a retired professor of geography to do a modern calculation just to see where we were. And he told me that there were three accepted methods for determining something such as a geographic center of the state. Mm-hmm. This is Dr. Ralph Fullerton.
Mm-hmm.
Well-known former member of the Planning Commission and such around the area. And applying the first method, and I won't go into how the methods differ, but applying the first method, the center of the state would be in Williamson County, just a few miles due east of Eagleville.
You didn't let that out, did you?
I hope they don't find that out. But then there's the second method.
Mm-hmm. Which I think I'm going to like that better.
Yeah, well, then we've got the third. The second method places it right about what's the Windrow community.
Oh, wow, in Rockvale?
Yeah, out in that area. Yeah. And to me, either one of those methods would have been acceptable and probably better than what our professor at the University of Nashville was doing. The third method, though, is mathematical using GPS coordinates and mathematical formula that have been developed. Yeah, and this was sounded to me like the most reliable scientific method. And using that, Dr. Fullerton pinpointed the geographic center of the state. It's on a farm just west of Flat Rock Road.
Wow, off the Woodbury Highway.
Due east. Due east of the courthouse, which if I were pressed, I would say that is probably the best calculation, although it's one of those things where what you decide to use as your method will give you a different result. Mm. But using these GPS coordinates and such, which means we could go over there now with a handheld GPS and stand on the spot with the precision of satellites and such now. But I looked at that and I thought, my goodness. So I went back to the original 1830s calculation. Mm. He's awfully close.
Wow.
Because he said due east, certain number of miles, and almost there, very close. So the old professor 150-some years ago. Yeah, 180 years ago. Did a pretty good job on a weekend job, weekend assignment, using just one map that they handed to him, and came out very close.
So our leaders here really had a vision when they built John Bragg Highway, because they feel like it sooner or later they're actually going to build and make Rutherford County put the state capitol right there on Flat Rock Road. Wouldn't that be interesting?
It would be convenient.
Yeah, it would.
We'd get good use out of that super four lane highway.
Well, wouldn't that be neat? We're going to get we've got a lot of use. I tell you what, that has really been a great boon for both Cannon County and Rutherford County because you know they've always been just like brothers. others anyway. There, I mean, I've often thought, you know, they could make one county and everybody would be happy with,
well,
with that, except for the name change.
Cannon County was cloned off of Rutherford County. We know that.
Yeah.
Rutherford County originally was almost the entire watershed of the East Fork as mm-hmm. well as the West Fork, which is rises out of the hills just east of Woodbury.
You know, we've got a lot of roots from Cannon County that live here in Rutherford County. Now, go ahead, because you're going to go somewhere, another direction.
Another direction. Well, when we brought this up 2 weeks ago, you made reference to the old adage about the Western lore.
Yeah, yeah.
And when the facts disagree with the legends, we go with the legends.
Right. That came from the movie Liberty Valance.
Yeah. I was in South Dakota last week and visited Deadwood, which is a beautiful restored western town.
It's a beautiful area.
Yeah, and we all know, or we should know, who was shot at Deadwood while sitting at the table with his back
aces
to the
and eights.
Back to the door. He was playing poker.
He had two gun holster.
Yeah.
And if I remember right, the pistols were always in reverse.
Yeah.
And we're
talking
about Wild Bill Hickok.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard ever since we learned to play poker the phrase dead man's hand,
right,
which is two aces and two eights.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know that it's five-card draw that he was playing. So what was the fifth card? There are three arguments. And while out there with just a little minimal research, I think I figured out how to reconcile the three arguments. Ripley's, believe it or not, says that the fifth card was a queen.
I've heard that.
There is some documentation from those who are literally at the table that says, no, the fifth card was a nine.
Hmm.
And then there is some research that said, no, he only had four cards in his hand. You know what I think could well have been had happened?
He hadn't got,
he got
last,
shot
before he got that last
after
card.
He discarded the nine.
Oh, okay.
And the card that he was about to draw would have been a queen,
mm-hmm.
but at the time he was shot, he only had four cards in his hand, aces and eights.
You think Wild Bill would have cared what that card was after that?
I think I've always liked to believe that he would have won that hand with the aces and eights, and it wouldn't have mattered what the fifth card was. But
well, you know, Western lore is so interesting to us, and we were talking about the Civil War, or the war between the states. We want that to be very factual. But when you're dealing with personalities like Wild Bill Hickok, Jesse James, Billy the Kid, and all those others, we want that to be bigger than life for some reason.
If we didn't romanticize those heroes, we wouldn't have near as high opinion of the Wild West in our own history, I think.
And you and I were talking about an interesting book that's been written, and just came out, and I've read part of what is in it, and it's basically about Butch Cassidy. And of course, everybody's seen the movie Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. But whatever happened to him has been disputed for many, many years.
I kind of like the way the movie did it. It had him under fire,
mm-hmm.
and then just backed off, mm-hmm. and left the rest of it to your imagination.
But, you know, after that movie, there was a lot of talk about he had actually come back home and was living a private life as another individual and took up another identity. Well, it's come out that he actually did come back, and that he is the one that probably was writing all the details down for the book.
Now, what a good opportunity. Create your own legend.
Yeah, create your own legend. But he was not portraying himself in his other identity. But he was saying things that some historians, here's where we get into the real interesting thing. Some historians say only he could have known those details. But there are other historians who are saying that it's just a bunch of rot, that it's not accurate at all. And that's the great thing about the West is, you can have your own opinion. It doesn't matter how you make it factual for other people. That doesn't matter. It's just in the person's mind that's reading it, where he wants to believe it or not.
You read Louis L'Amour?
Some of Louis L'Amour.
Oh, I love
Riders
it.
Of the Purple Sage.
Yeah, that's not Louis L'Amour. That's
it was,
the other one. No, that was the other one, wasn't it?
I thought it was Louis L'Amour.
now I'm blocking on another name, but Louis wrote several hundred books.
Yeah.
And when I travel, I'll go over to the used bookstore and pick up three or four of them.
Now, you know there's going to be somebody from one of the book places is going to call now and put me in my place.
Yeah.
I don't like that, but it'll happen.
Well, I'm blocking on the name of the other author. But, yeah, you can read a Louis L'Amour book in about 4 hours. So if you fly in, you know, long distance, it's just about right. Take two books, one to read, one to go. And you know when you're reading it, it's fictionalized. Mm-hmm. But he is so good at the physical description of the part of the country he's in. Mm-hmm. He uses the actual names of the streams and the hills and the sections. And he'll even occasionally throw in Wild Bill Hickok or Kit Carson or somebody's name like that to make it, you know, seem real. And it's just good time. And if people persuaded me that the Wild West never existed, that'd take all the fun out of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've grown up believing all this.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the interesting things that I've always – is all the different people that went west and some of the hardships. Of course, that was true. I mean, the hardships were unbelievable. But yet they wanted to create a new home for themselves, and they wanted to be part of the American dream. I mean, mm-hmm. back then, it was just like it is now. You want a home and a place to take care of and something to call your own. But there were so many different types of people. A friend of mine, Sheila Wright, gave me a book on Far and Away. You know, that's the old movie of Ireland and where they were having all kinds of political problems and a lot of poverty there, and they came over to the United States, and some of them stayed, of course, as you know, in New York, and they spread out and went to the Oklahoma land rush. And that is one of the most interesting things about the West, is how people got involved in that. And I can still see that movie where they have got a shot of all those horses and wagons lined up just nose to nose by the hundreds of them. And then when that shot goes off for them to take off, you can see the horses bolt up and then kind of flinch and then they take off. And the when the Mormons headed west, that's very interesting because they were ostracized everywhere they went.
They were under pressure.
They were under pressure from the Indians and the people who already moved out there.
And Joseph Smith leading them, they didn't know where they were going. They were just going because they had to.
But they fought back.
Mm-hmm.
And they fought back against tremendous odds, which everybody does. And if you think about it, the real truth of the stories that went out there are just as great and as big as the Western lore that we have created for them. And if you think of the guys, the bandits, they were like the Robin Hoods of England, the bandits were. And I've always thought that was very unusual. Of course, a lot of that was post-war, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, most of the Western legends that we're familiar with are in that period, 1870 to 1900, in that period. And you remind me also, one thing I would recommend to someone going to the Black Hills or Badlands area, all of it is beautiful and interesting, but the Crazy Horse Memorial.
It was actually the hero of the Sioux Indians. He really was.
Yeah, almost a magical, mythical figure.
A Sitting Bull was more of a guy that would see things, see omens and stuff like that. I guess we would call him more of a medicine man, not exactly what he was, but Crazy Horse was the one that was the actual leader.
Well, there's a mountain being carved into the Crazy Horse Memorial, which is more of a memorial to the entire Sioux or Plains Indian population. One individual worked on it for 60 years before he died.
That's amazing.
Completed the face of the Indian, which is from chin to forehead, is 53 feet. And he's going to be, according to the model they have there, he's going to be on a horse charging with his hand outstretched, and if and when completed. And a number of the children of the original sculptor are now working on it. And they apparently are doing a very good job raising money and applying modern methods to do it. It will be the largest sculpture in the world.
That's amazing.
And yeah, and I made one really impressive picture. I lined up the model, which is sitting out where you can walk around it and see it, with the mountain right behind it, and you can see the mountain taking the shape of that heroic figure and all. Another interesting thing that kind of ties back here, you know, that the United Daughters of the Confederacy paid for, it was their idea, the Stone Mountain Memorial, mm-hmm. which is, again, is a heroic sculpture made out of the natural stone there. And they hired, and it's always a mistake, they hired a Yankee sculptor.
Oh, that was great.
Borglum was his last mm-hmm. name. And he came up and expanded and developed the idea of what it should be, or proposed what it should be. But a few weeks into the work, they were so aggravated with this fella that they fired him. And that, of
they
course,
fired the Yankee.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which, and hopefully hired a local. But what's interesting is it was that firing and all the publicity around that that prompted the people out in South Dakota to contact him and hire him. And he's the one that did the Mount Rushmore, the four heads on Mount Rushmore.
Well, on that point, let's take a quick break and let you know that part of the show was brought to you by Pirtle and Howerton Automotive. And they're at 2006 North Main Street in Shevelville, Tennessee. And you can reach them at 1-800-264-6800 or PirtleHowerton.com. And if you're looking for a Ford, Mercury, Chevrolet, Buick, or GMC, then don't let a 20-minute drive slow you down. Just head out there. This would be a great day to go out, look at a few vehicles, sit there and drink a cup of coffee with them, and just chat, and they would be glad to see you. And I think that it'll be a drive that's well worth the while. And I have just been smacked in the face again.
Ever heard of Zane Grey?
Yes. Brian Barrett is a troublemaker.
It's not me. It was one of your listeners.
And as soon as I saw that name, I knew exactly that I was wrong. And I will admit it. I will be a big person and admit my mistakes when I am caught.
When you're caught.
When I am caught. But
I gotcha.
Not before then. To
your credit, The Riders of the Purple Sage is one of the first and one of the best Western novels ever written, Zane Grey.
Yeah.
And if I remember right, it touched on the Mormons. There was
it
some,
did?
Yeah, it had some of the Mormon experience there.
And it told of, I don't know how accurate all that is, but they had what I think they called angels or something like that, that were actually, they would be their gunfighters.
Yeah.
And they would be their protectors, and they would go out and protect the people when harm came there. And, I could talk about the Old West. I wish we ought to go out there one day and put on our two-gun holsters and maybe recreate history again. Wouldn't that be neat?
If you go to Deadwood or one of those other little towns around the Black Hills, they have gunfights every night.
I have seen the ones in Arizona.
Yeah, Tombstone's got to go.
Yeah, and it is such a great place to go. And Brian is getting antsy, but I'm not ready to go. Are you? I mean, this
Where
is too much
going?
Fun.
It's too cold to go outside.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break then.
We're at the Garden Patch Thrift Store on Spring Street. It's across from the tall NHC building. Christy Sanford says they're open Tuesday through Saturday, and they take donations.
We get donations from all sorts of just regular people, as well as we've even had estates, which is a great thing because we are a nonprofit, and so we do give tax donation forms.
The Garden Patch Thrift Store, open Tuesday through Saturday on Spring Street across from the tall NHC building.
Anytime the store is open, we do accept donations.
If you want to get some barbecue, I tell you how to do it. Head for the Slick Pig and you're into it. Just walk through the door at 1920 East Main and your nose will send a message right to your brain.
Now at Slick Pig Barbecue, try the Catfish Special. Wednesday night between 4 and 8 o'clock, $9.99 plus tax for all-you-can-eat catfish. The meal includes hush puppies, white beans, and homemade coleslaw at Slick Pig Barbecue.
It's The Truman Show, a look at the people and news shaping Rutherford County with Truman Jones.
We've got about 1 minute, Greg, and I want you to tell the people when you were in the Black Hills, when you first saw the president's faces, how did that hit you?
Well, you know, you go down that way. You go through a little town, and it gives you direct, you head down that way, mm-hmm. thinking you're going to see something interesting. And the way the road is laid, that about halfway down there, they rise up over the hill in front of you. And we stopped because, you know, that was my first, and the scale, the size, and it was a bright, sunny day, and it's brilliantly white, and it's right at the peak of the mountain, so you see that almost like it's floating. And, yeah, it grabs you in the chest if you're, you know, if you're so inclined. And then you can go on up, and, of course, we ended up climbing up under the chin. And looking at, you know, how it was done, and hearing the stories. And I met and talked to and actually got an autograph from. He may be the only surviving member of the team that sculpted it. Name's Clifford. And first thing I had noticed was there's a plaque listing every man that did any of the carving. And there's about 100 or several hundred of them maybe. And it was placed there by this Nick Clifford. Mm-hmm. And then I went in the gift shop and was just browsing around, and there was this elderly-looking fellow sitting there almost kind of like he was asleep with his eyes open. And I looked up, and it had a sign up, you know, Nick Clifford. So I went over and talked to him. And he was talking about how one of the proudest things about it is that in all the time and all, it took him 14 years to do it, and numbers of people, no one was killed.
Wow.
Which might sound strange to us today with OSHA and all that business, but go read the history of the Brooklyn Bridge or most of the other major engineering feats.
Hoover
and
Dam.
Such. Hoover
yeah.
Dam. How many, you know, were killed? None were killed at all. They had several injuries, but none that were of life-threatening nature. And he told about how they'd climb up on top of the thing, and they had set up their chairs on winches, mm-hmm. on cables, and then they'd lower the guys down, and they'd spend all day swinging back and forth on the cable, working on the sculptures.
What kind of tools did they have?
Well, they started off with dynamite and drilling holes, mm-hmm. and about 90% of the work was done with dynamite, but of course that was, for them, the easier part. Mm-hmm. Then they went up there with pneumatic tools, mm-hmm. and using compressed air power. They had to build their own they had to generate their own electricity and had to set up their own you know, everything. They were really out in the hills, in the wilderness. It's quite a story.
They almost had to use some type of scientific method to even use the dynamite, I would think, with all the...
Well,
they had to know how much damage it was going to do.
Well, Clifford had a souvenir that he had saved, and he said he wished he had saved a bunch of them because he's been offered thousands of dollars for it. But it looks like a piece of Swiss cheese, mm-hmm. only the holes are lined up, and they're very close together, no more than about an inch between the holes. And this is the way they would drill so that they could use very small charges, mm-hmm. and really control exactly what they were taking off. And after they got it down to kind of a rough visage, they then would come back with the jackhammers, and then they would come back with pneumatic-driven, what would you call it, like a sander, mm-hmm. a grinder, and eventually they'd come up with a flamethrower like thing and use the heat to do the final finish on it. And it's as smooth and fine as, you know, the Formica top desk in places where they've done all that. And lots of little things, like they didn't know until they got started where the natural cracks might be. Thomas Jefferson had a crack right square across his nose, and Borglum got worried that the nose could, it would look funny without a nose. So they recast it, not cast, they re-engineered it, and Jefferson's the only one looking heavenward, and that's because they had to tilt back the angle of the sculpture in order to get the crack through his mouth rather than right across the bridge of his nose.
Could you actually get on top of where they are?
No, the tourist access now doesn't put you on top, but that's the way they work. They work from the top down. So, yeah, there's. In fact, they've got pictures. You can see the buildings they had to build up on top to house the equipment and such. And I forget, but they'd spend the first hour and a half just climbing steps and ladders to get up there each day to do the work.
When you see things of that significance most of your life, I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of the West, and when we went out, Jackie and I went out west, we went to Monument Valley. And, of course, that's John Ford's favorite place to, mm-hmm. to film movies. A lot of John Wayne movies were filmed there.
Natural monuments.
Yeah, natural monuments. And I mean, it just reaches and takes you back, and it's just a great treat. And I recommend those type of travels mm-hmm. for anybody. I mean, you can see all you want to see right here in the United States without ever having to go anywhere.
Yeah, and what I didn't realize about Rushmore, my wife, of course, is from Southeast Asia. Mount Rushmore, the Grand Canyon, and just a few other things. People all over the world, when they learn a little bit about the United States, they've heard of Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. So my wife, since she was a small child in school,
wow.
knew that somewhere in the United States there was a mountain with the faces of our founding fathers, some of them. And so she was thrilled to actually see it.
That's amazing. Well, I guess you're going to be on with me in a couple of weeks. A
couple of weeks.
2 weeks from today, and I always look forward to it. And we're going to wrap this show up. It's been a wonderful time. Now, I believe Nick Barris is going to be on the show with me tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And he called me yesterday. He's got some obligations, but he's going to try his best. But for right now, he's going to be our guest tomorrow. And we'll see you tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Everybody have a safe day, a great day. Stay inside as much as you can and stay out of this weather.